free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you'll see a past and upcoming lineup of speakers, links to our downloads, and also phone numbers if you want. If you're listening live, you can call in, ask some questions. Toward the end of the hour, if we've not gotten to something and you want to know, go ahead and give us a jingle and ask. Our guest today, May 12, 2008, is Lee Fellows. He's with the Fellows Research Group, and they have a thermoacoustic cycle generator. This uses heat to amplify acoustic waves or sound waves in high-pressure gas. These amplified acoustic oscillations drive a unique kind of generator and produce electrical power. This system can allegedly be built at very low cost, and it can produce power from almost any source of heat, whether it's solar or fossil-based. And when it does a fossil-based fuel, it does so very efficiently, and we're going to learn more about that today. Thanks for joining us, Lee.
Thank you, Sterling. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure, and been looking forward to learning more about this system. Not only can you produce power through acoustic waves, but you're also doing it very efficiently. We're talking like half the cost of the cheapest energy available today. Did I get that right? Do I understand that right?
That's correct. We can, from the standpoint of the manufacturing cost of the equipment, we can compete with fossil fuel equipment. We're probably the only alternative, what you would call all alternative energy technology, that actually can compete with fossil equipment in terms of plant cost.
Uh-huh.
Generally, it's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of about $500 per kilowatt.
I know solar tries to, kind of their target is to get down to about a dollar per watt for installation costs. And you're saying you're at 50 cents per watt?
Well, that's not, we're talking about, actually, the manufacturing cost would be less than that. We're looking at a target cost of $250 a kilowatt in large quantity production, of course.
Mm-hmm.
When we get into MEMS devices, it may even be less than that. It's less than 25 cents a watt. That's our cost, or our manufacturer's cost, for his labor, tooling, materials, etc. He's going to sell that at a wholesale or distributor or whatever manufacturer's cost, OEM cost, to someone else at somewhere between that and whatever his competitive target price is. Right now, for example, the market is such that we would be competing probably with photovoltaics for solar generated electricity, and we could compete with them very well. The manufacturer, the OEM, could probably sell at a dollar a watt and easily outcompete them.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about energy generation and the cost to the consumer, we usually think in terms of kilowatt hours and usually from the grid. You're looking at, in a cheap location, wholesale is in the ballpark of 4 cents per kilowatt hour. How would your system compare to that?
It would be competitive. As you know, solar is area-dependent, climate-dependent, all that sort of thing. in an area like California, the California desert, where you have a large solar insulation. This type of equipment, TAC equipment, could compete in terms of the cost to the generator, probably in the neighborhood of a little bit over a penny per kilowatt hour. That's his amortization costs and maintenance costs, et cetera. And so he could sell it easily. He could compete with any fossil plant like coal or oil or whatever, gas-fired power generation, in terms of the selling price, and make a good profit.
Well, let's talk about the system itself and get into how it works. You're using acoustic waves, sound waves, to turn the turbine, or is it a solid state system, or do you have both solid state?
It's a linear alternator, a reciprocating alternator, like a piston that goes back and forth. To get to the heart of it, the basics of it, sound waves are just high density, dynamic areas that are moving through a static medium, and naturally sound, or predominantly sound, we're working with a compressible or an elastic fluid, a gas. When you increase the density of a gas, it becomes a better conductor in terms of heat. What have you. It also has more kinetic energy. A dynamic sound wave, a traveling wave that's moving through an elastic medium, because that pressure wave has a greater density, it can take up heat faster. So if we apply heat to a resonant heat exchanger, a resonant cavity that's also a heat exchanger, any sound wave or perturbation, we'll call it, that's traveling through there will take up heat better than the fluid that it's moving through. I hope this is understandable anyway. Since it takes up heat faster, you're actually, most of the energy that you apply to it amplifies that high pressure zone or that traveling acoustic wave. So it takes up heat, and you can use that amplified pressure wave then to do dynamic work on a generator. And essentially, the generator is one of the best ways to look at it is as a loudspeaker that's operated in reverse. The sound wave is causing the diaphragm or the piston to move. It moves an electrical coil inside a magnet structure, and that movement generates electricity in the coil. And that's the way it works. We use the heat to increase that dynamic. So the perturbation or the sound wave that we generate, the trigger signal, is a very small parasitic quantity that is not a very great quantity compared to what we're going to get out of it. For example, if we put in a 10 watts of energy into the trigger signal to create this perturbation, this moving or traveling wave within the working fluid. And then we put in 10 kilowatts of heat from some external source, and it can be solar heat or geothermal heat or exhaust heat from some sort of industrial process or whatever. What we're going to do, we're going to get out about 6 kilowatts of electricity And the amplification factor there would be 6,300 watts, say, versus the 10 watts. So the parasitic part of it is a very small part of it. So for every 10 kilowatts of heat we put into the system, the maximum theoretical energy that we can get out electrically is 6,300 watts. There'll be some other losses like friction and that sort of thing, but still we're going to have a very efficient system that's going to convert roughly half of the energy input to it into electrical power.
Now, when you talk about these kinds of efficiencies, let's compare that to what is typical in the solar industry. And they're lucky if they're getting above 20% efficient of converting the solar energy across the entire spectrum into electricity. What kind of efficiencies would you be talking about in a solar setup?
In a normal solar, say if it's a solar concentrator where you've got fairly high operating temperatures, a fairly high delta T across the heat exchangers, you can look at, you can expect efficiencies after all your equipment losses and line losses and et cetera are factored in, of somewhere between 30% and 40%.
That's about as high as I've ever heard in the solar, of converting solar into electricity.
Well, how can I put this? It's the thermoacoustic engine is a Carnot engine. It's almost an ideal Carnot cycle machine. You've only got one moving part in it, and that's the generator diaphragm. So if you keep that inertial mass of that diaphragm relatively small in relation to the energy that's input to it, then your efficiency is going to be very high. If you had no moving parts, you could expect, theoretically, efficiencies as high as 63% of Carnot. And even with the losses in there, you'll get probably 50% greater efficiency than, say, a Stirling cycle machine can deliver, simply because of the dynamics that are involved, all of the moving components, the friction, et cetera, and whatnot. The thermoacoustic engine doesn't have that.
Well, let's put this into context. One of our top 100 energy technologies has actually been sitting in the top 10 for near the entire time that we've had this list for a couple of years, is called Stirling Energy Systems. It's a group that is installing utility-scale solar systems where they have a solar concentrating dish that reflects the sunlight onto a Stirling engine, which then turns a turbine, it turns from the Stirling cycle, which then generates electricity. And you're saying that your system in the same position could get 60% more energy from the same input of heat.
Probably about 50% greater output energy than the Stirling. So if it's 25% efficient and you 50% of that would be to add roughly 10 or 12% efficiency to that. It'd put it up in the 30% to 35% range. The Stirling engine that you're talking about was invented by Professor Beal back in the 1970s, and NASA spent a great deal of money in development of it. They were looking at it for space applications and what have you. And essentially, it's a free piston Stirling machine, meaning the difference between that and a kinematic machine is that it doesn't have a crankshaft. The pistons inside, the piston and displacer, bounce back and forth in a pressurized gas and use a gas spring in a tuned cavity to make this machine operate at 60 hertz or whatever the operating speed of it is. Typically, they try to design it for a 60 hertz system. And essentially, what is the way it operates, the piston is a magnetic slug, and the piston cylinder is wound with a coil, a copper coil of wire. This is the field coil. The magnetic slug that's bouncing back and forth at 60 hertz is the armature. And as that magnet moves back and forth inside that coil of wire, it generates power. They've eliminated the crankcase and the gaskets and the lubrication and all of those factors from the Stirling engine in order to try to make it more efficient. It doesn't have any bearings, et cetera, to speak of, anyway. So it's very similar to what we're doing, except that we've eliminated the displacer and the magnetic piston, and we're using an amplified pressure wave to move a much lighter piston or a diaphragm-type piston. So we've got less inertial losses, or inertial moments are much less for a given amount of power that is generated. Does that make sense?
Now, without seeing pictures and stuff, it's going to go over my head a little bit, but I would think that the people who are in the industry would appreciate your explanation. As you were giving that explanation of what the Professor Buell had done with NASA funding and support, I was wondering if you were describing your system or theirs, because it sounded very similar to what you were describing.
No, we haven't had any support to speak of, and no government support. We've gotten some small private investors. We actually started this company, some friends and I, some fellow scientists, we all worked for the government at one time or another, and we started a company in 1985 in Austin, Texas, called Thermomotor Corporation, and we tried to attract investors for a long time, and we just couldn't get anybody interested. Finally, gave up. It really wasn't until Greg Swift up at Los Alamos got involved that back in the early 90s, I guess, somewhere along in there, he and several of the people that have come out of his shop, like Stephen Garrett, who's now head of the thermoacoustics program up at Penn State. There was a man named Hoffler, and a couple of others that were involved in thermoacoustics research. We were quite a bit ahead of them, but they had the money and the backing, the federal budget to work with. And, of course, Greg Swift, being in his position at Los Alamos, had the stature that was necessary to attract the interest also. If anybody's interested in, there are a number of universities have sprung up in the last 10 years, 10 or 12 years that have programs in thermoacoustics. One is the University of Texas, Brigham Young University, I think it is, up in Utah, Salt Lake City. A number of them overseas and whatnot. Several government labs are interested. DARPA is putting money into thermoacoustics research over the last 5 or 6 years. So there are a lot of people getting interested in it, and so we're not out on the fringe or anything anymore. We're becoming mainstream as the rest of the as more and more people get involved.
Are there any products available on the marketplace today that integrate this technology, or is it still cutting teeth into the market?
I can't think of anything right now that's commercially available. Penn State, their thermoacoustics department, put out a little, sells a little kit where you can build a thermoacoustic engine inside of a test tube, that kind of thing, just a little lab bench demonstrator. Anyone that's really wants to explore it, there are a number of sites that will pop up if you type in thermoacoustics, and that's just one word, into a search engine like Google. You'll see there will be a lot of stuff that will pop up and will lead you to different links around the world of various people that are involved in this.
Can you spell thermoacoustic without the L? Thermo, M-O,
yeah.
Acoustic?
T-H-E-R-M-O-A-C-O-U-S-T-I-C. One word, thermoacoustic.
Well, let's talk about where your company is at presently in terms of rolling it out into some kind of a commercial application.
Well, right now we're negotiating with a couple of different companies that are interested in funding development. If they do, if one of them goes through, we will hope to see something in the prototype stage, just our pre-commercialization stage, put it that way. Within 12 months or less. Probably, if all goes well, we'll see something on the market within 12 to 18 months. And what we're looking at two specific areas. One is a MEMS device, a micro miniature generator. We would like to be able to embed these in shingles and paving tiles for patios and driveways and sidewalks and these kinds of things, fascia and decorative tile for building siding, for example, like the marble siding you see on office buildings and things like that. We'd like to be able to integrate the MEMS device into absorptive thermal masses like that. This would be a ceramic material that we've designed that has a fairly high specific heat and can hold a good amount of energy. That acts as it absorbs energy, acts as an absorption service to collect the energy, and it also acts as a buffer that slows down. In other words, if the sun passes by in a cloud or something like that, you don't get an immediate or abrupt stop.
I believe that's the image.
So that it can keep generating power.
I think that's the image that I have in relation to this announcement of today's interview. It looks like almost like a X-ray of a ribcage where you've got, you know, protruding things coming from like a spinal column, that looks almost like a solid state, the image does. Do you have moving parts in there?
Yes, we're working on two. One of them is a kinematic device. It still has a very small diaphragm that moves. We're also, I'm getting into some proprietary areas here, but we're also looking at a solid state device where we will use the thermoacoustic wave, the temperature gradient in there, to produce electrical energy in a solid matrix. And there won't be any moving parts. That's a little ways down the road, though. We probably won't see those for 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Is that using like a piezoelectric effect?
No, it's not. It's actually a thermomagnetic effect. There's been a lot of experimentation and discussion, on the internet. There are old patents out. There were a couple by Tesla way back around the turn of the century. And there have been others that have worked in them, and it's a property, a material property called a Curie point, or it's a transition of a material, a metal, from a magnetic to a non-magnetic state. And that can be switched on and off using heat. And if we do it properly, design our equipment properly, then we can use a high frequency thermoacoustic wave to trip a magnetic field back and forth. And that moving that acts like a moving magnet, a moving magnetic field. That will generate power in a conductor, current in a conductor.
Huh. Now, earlier when you were describing this piston that goes back and forth in a linear alternator, in a typical engine, you have some kind of a combusting gas that causes a piston to move. In your case, what's causing the piston to move is this thermoacoustic resonance, that you've got this thing going back and forth in a resonant manner, and the heat applied increases the force, or the increases the intensity with which that thing is moving, and you've got a magnet that's going past coils in that configuration to generate your electricity?
All right. It's the best way to look at it, and if you look at the engine in your automobile, you have a gas inside, just normal air inside that cylinder, and you inject a small quantity of fuel vapor into that and ignite it, and the heat that's generated by the combustion of that fuel causes that air, that gas in there, to expand and drive the piston. In a thermoacoustic engine, you're doing essentially the same thing, but the heat is coming from the outside. Rather than injecting fuel inside the engine, we're applying heat to the outside of a heat exchanger. And we're using sound waves to make that heat or that expansion take place in a periodic a pulsating, I guess would be the simplest way to put it, way, so that you're doing exactly the same thing, except it's an external combustion engine instead of an internal combustion engine. It's similar to a Stirling cycle. Actually, the Stirling cycle, to be absolutely accurate, is an acoustic cycle. The old Stirling cycle engine, if you look at the classic explanation of the Stirling cycle, it's only good as long as the engine is running at very low RPM, say around 100 RPM. Once you get above that, the gas in there has inertia. Just like hurricanes and tornadoes can blow down buildings, that moving air has mass. And it, as such, it has inertia. And this, the way the thermoacoustics developed, at least in our case, is we recognized in a Stirling engine that when you've got a Stirling engine, it's running 4,000 or 5,000 RPM. The gas in there is not actually moving. The heat's being conveyed back and forth by an acoustic pressure wave. Because the gas itself can't move that fast. So it doesn't, it's not an aspirated engine like you would believe, or like the classic cycle. Even though it's an internal, internally contained gas, the gas in the classic Stirling cycle moves from one heat exchanger to another and back again, as it takes up and gives up heat. But when an engine like that is running at several thousand RPM, that's not what's happening. It's a compression wave that's moving back and forth. Just like water, a wave moving through the ocean or something like that, the actual water isn't moving. It's the force that's moving through the water and transmitting the energy.
So as the Stirling engine goes from low to high RPMs, it's turning into an acoustic engine?
That's correct.
Now, let's go the other direction. In your system where your target is an acoustic effect, is there a drop-off point on the low end where it stops being acoustic and turns into something else?
No, not really, because of the way the equipment itself is designed. It couldn't operate any other way. It has no mechanical parts in there to move gases back and forth or move them in any direction. We're simply generating what's called a sound wave, a pressure oscillation, inside a cavity that essentially has nothing else in it. There aren't any mechanical parts.
Now, when you do a power curve on the performance of this thing, what does the curve look like? Is it linear, or is there a sweet spot at a certain RPM where you really get a lot of power and then it drops off? What does that curve look like from low RPM to high RPM, low energy input to high energy input in terms of heat?
Well, the most accurate graph of it looks like a sawtooth. You've got your both your pressure and temperature dynamic. If you're graphing it off of let's say you've got a parallel or horizontal line, rather, perpendicular to that, your rise time would begin very abruptly and be very steep, almost straight up. And then as the delta begins to diminish, in other words, the temperature differences across the heat exchangers get less and less toward the culmination of one half cycle, that curve would bend over and become more, you know, it would flatten out so that your actual gain in terms of temperature and pressure are not per unit of energy input are not that much. And then it would reach a point where that half cycle ends and abruptly fall like very dramatically until again your heat exchangers begin to approach the same temperature at the other end, and then you get a ski slope turn where it begins to flatten out again. So if you graph it, it looks like a sawtooth, with a curved side and a straight drop-off and a curved foot, curved toe on the other side.
Would that have ramifications in terms of the governability of this thing if you were using it in an automobile, for example, and you wanted to slowly increase or decrease the speed of the vehicle? Would it be difficult to do that?
No, you wouldn't apply it that way. You would use it as you use an engine in a hybrid vehicle. Highest efficiency comes at whatever the engine is designed for, a set temperature differential, set pressure, etc. So you gear a thermoacoustic engine or set your system up so that it operates at a constant speed, and it generates power, and then you take that power off, that electrical power, to drive electric motors, just as you would in a Prius or one of those hybrid vehicles.
So it's basically keeping the batteries at a certain baseline that then increases or decreases depending on regenerative braking acceleration over and under that curve.
Right. Your batteries actually would operate as the buffered device or the provide you with surge type power and that sort of thing, while your generator is running at a constant speed and feeding a uniform charge into those batteries, then they can fluctuate as the driver demands, the vehicle demands.
Let's talk about the combustion process when you're using, this can either be a renewable energy system, pulling energy from geothermal or solar, for example, or it could be an efficient burner of petrol fuels. Let's talk about the petrol for a minute. Why does this system burn more efficiently? And one of the questions that I have is, I know in a petrol engine, the typical internal combustion engine, you have an ignition, you have an explosion that drives the pistons down. And if I understand right, in your system, you don't have those high pressures, you don't have the explosion. It's more of a flaring, a constant flare that is creating that delta T, the temperature difference that is driving the thermoacoustic engine.
Right. In a combustion fuel arrangement, hot side heat exchanger, it's both a waveguide and a heat exchanger. It's mounted in a burner or combustor arrangement, so you have a burner just like you would with a gas range or a boiler, a gas boiler or something like of that nature. The reason it's more efficient and has very low emissions is because in an automobile you're injecting a cold fuel essentially into a chamber along with relatively cool air, and combustion is not all that efficient. And also because of that you generate pollutants like nitrous oxides and what have you. You can be inside of a building, for example, say a garage with an automobile running, and a human being would be asphyxiated fairly rapidly from the emissions, the carbon monoxides and what have you that are generated by that engine. But if you take a relatively clean fuel like natural gas or propane or something like that, and you burn it on a low-pressure external combustion device, and like ours, we would have a catalytic surface on there also, then you could be in there just as you can with a gas kitchen range you cook food on and suffer no ill effects. The emissions are extremely low, very few nitrous oxides or other pollutants, just mostly carbon dioxide and water vapor out of the fuel.
So talk about your, you know, go ahead and finish, then we'll go on to the next question.
Well, on a, that's essentially it. Heat's transferred much more efficiently through something with a steady-state burner than it is with a pulse combustion type of arrangement where you've got fresh fuel and cold air that's cooling the system off in each power stroke, you know.
I know in some fuel efficiency scenarios, we have an index page on our site where we have a whole bunch of ways to improve your vehicle's mileage by doing this or that. And one of the methods is to preheat your fuel so that you don't have that problem of cold fuel. And it's actually quite dangerous because you know, you have this pressurized hot gas that can explode before it gets to the engine. If you have an accident or something, you've got a problem on your hand. But I'm wondering, in your system, you're not actually preheating the fuel, but because you have a constant flame, is that why it burns more efficiently? Because you have that continuous.
Well, you can do a lot of different things when you've got a steady state burner configuration like this. You can put a catalytic surface on there that. gives you more of a monoatomic combustion process. In other words, the combustion takes place on the surface of the heat exchanger rather than the heat having to migrate through spent gases and whatnot in order to get to the heat exchanger. I had something else in mind, but it's gone out the window. I'll have to come back to it, I guess, if I think of it. Another example, graphic example of why a burner is a more efficient.
Would your system,
for one thing, it's the surface gets hot and stays hot. Rather than being cooled by a spray of fuel and cool air each time. Also, you can, with a burner configuration, you can preheat your combustion air and your fuel. You can do all the same things to make it more efficient.
Is that part of the design, is to preheat the fuel?
Yes, and we would take, you know, you use... in anything like this, particularly in alternative energy systems, as conscious as we are of emissions and pollutants and fuel consumption and all those kinds of things anymore, you're going to do everything that makes economic sense. There at some point will be a point where the financial gain or the gain that you get out of it doesn't make good economic sense or becomes too expensive to employ, and then of course you quit. But in this kind of system, you can do a catalytic wash on the heat exchanger elements. You can easily set up so that your combustion feed air comes through your heat rejection system on your coal-fired heat exchanger first, so that you're using it you're employing it to take heat out of the coal-fired heat exchanger and bring that heat back to preheat the combustion air that's going into your hot side heat exchanger. So there are all kinds kinds of things that you can do that don't cost a great deal, make good economic sense, and make the equipment more efficient.
Let's talk about your intellectual property portfolio. What of these various things we talked about, where do you have patents, where are you filed, where are they awarded?
We have two United States patents. We have others ready to file, but we don't want to file them until we get funding, and we can then get international patents. An international patent generally runs many thousands of dollars. It's, in fact, as much as a couple hundred thousand dollars. We haven't had that kind of funding. We put everything we have into developing the mechanics and what have you, developing the theoretical basis for the technology and everything. So right now we have a patent on a large generator and one on a MEMS device. And if we get off the ground and begin to develop stuff for, you know, to commercialize the technology, then naturally we're gonna file a lot of patents, and we'll try to get them, you know, as as much protection as is reasonably available, you know, through patents.
What do you have by way of prototypes and test data on those prototypes?
Well, we have a small engine. We've built a lot of these things. There's one that's in an older video that's on our website. And if your listeners will just Google or use a search engine and look for Fellows Research Group, they should be able to pop up our website. And there is, if you scroll down the main page, the first page there, somewhere about two-thirds of the way down, it says Watch TAC Video. There's about a 10-minute video there that demonstrates a working engine.
I was looking at that today, and I was wondering if it'd be okay with you if I went ahead and posted that on YouTube so it's easier for people to embed that on their sites to look at it.
Sure, I would appreciate it, actually.
Okay. We are creating a feature page at PezWiki.com about that. This will be showing up at probably it's our feature story tomorrow. And the keywords, again, will be thermoacoustic and Fellows. We'll pull up that page easily. So in terms of, you've had small engines, you've built quite a few. Have you had this independently tested yet?
No, we haven't. We haven't wanted to disseminate anything that contains proprietary knowledge. In other words, we would like to get our equipment to market and establish ourselves before we go out to Underwriters Laboratory and people like that to, you know, an independent laboratory to have performance verified. And we don't expect in the first two or three iterations, maybe, of this thing before we get it ready for market, we don't expect to get as high efficiency or as good a performance as we will with the end product. We want to get something that performs near the theoretical efficiency, as near as we can get, and something that's also designed to be economical in manufacture. And that's one of the challenges that we face.
What's going to be your first iteration, your low-hanging fruit that you're going to go after when you first roll this thing out? What size, what application?
We're going to go for two different things. The first is a micro generator. The difficulty in the engineering process with this type of equipment, as in most other things, is when you try to get very small or you try to get larger, you have different problems of scale and whatnot. So we're going to start off with some sort of intermediate device, maybe of a few watts to a few hundred watts. We're going to try to put it in a panel arrangement for solar initially. And as we develop the efficiency and that sort of thing, then we want to embed it in the building materials, as I said before, like ceramic shingles, ceramic tiles, and those kinds of things that can be integrated into house and building construction. Visual impact is one of the things that detractors from solar energy talk about. They don't like the panels on the roof and those kinds of things. And also, it's an additional system. It's an additional expense. But let's say that you're building a house and you're going to roof that house. Well, that roof is going to cost you something to begin with. There's actually somewhere in the neighborhood of about 400 billion in housing starts every year in the United States. And probably 4 or 5% of that, anyway, is the roofing system that goes in. So if you add a small amount to that in terms of the cost of the material that goes on, you can have a roof that generates power or siding on a building that generates power. That's built into the system along, it's mortgaged with the rest of the house. It's not an add-on system, although other houses that already exist could be retrofit with a new roof or something. But it's an essential part of the construction anyway. You're gonna pay something X amount out for a roof, so if it's X amount plus a few percent, to get a house that generates its own power, and then you're miles ahead in terms of bringing this technology into an alternative energy in general into an affordable state.
You mentioned a couple of things. What was the other one?
The other one is will be a larger generator that can be generally used to harvest waste heat. We can put it in the exhaust systems of automobiles, and it can be fit into the exhaust manifold, for example. And the waste heat from the gasoline engine also drives the power generation so that you don't have an alternator. You're getting more energy out of that fuel instead of taking horsepower away from the engine to turn the alternator. The waste heat is driving, is generating the electrical power for the vehicle.
That would be a retrofit that you could put on existing vehicles to then take the belt off the off the alternator.
Right. And with all that excess power that you have there, a little four-cylinder engine generates about 65 kilowatts of waste heat. If you tap off even a small portion of that, it's ample amount of power to drive all the electrical systems, and it can also drive a solid-state air conditioning system. And this increases your mileage quite a bit and also lowers emissions significantly. This machine in various forms can go into boilers and incinerators, into the exhaust stacks of other power generating plants, a lot of process heat, like your laundry, your commercial laundries, food processing plants. All these things generate a lot of waste heat. Chemical plants, all those things can it can be used to recover up to maybe 15-20% of the energy that normally just goes up the stack and is wasted.
Yeah.
In an automobile, it can harvest about 25% of that waste energy.
Well, Lee, we've come to the end of our segment. I appreciate you coming on our show with us today. It's been fascinating to learn about your technology. We certainly wish you the best. We've been talking with Lee Fellows from the Fellows Research Group, thermoacoustic generator technology, and welcome to go to pezwiki.com to read more about that as we get our feature page up, and you can Google them to find their website as well. Thanks again.
Thank you, Sterling. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Bye.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.